99.1 PLR. Let's count them down. The Chaz and AJ Window Nation Top 10.
Oh, my God. Just tell them to shut up.
Really?
Put them on hold.
God's sake.
Sorry. Hi, Tom G.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Yeah, it's early, brother. Woo! Watch it.
Not for us.
No.
I don't know. I don't like it. It's getting dark out now in the morning. It's kind of bums me out. I hate getting up when it's dark out. You're probably used to it. I'm not.
Retired Stanford fire chief. Not the chief, but a chief.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Tom G. Deputy chief on the phone. Thank you for your service.
Yes, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
And we'll get into it later, but I'll ask you what September 11th was like around Stanford. I know, crazy, but we're doing top 10 coolest firefighter tools and gadgets.
Roger
Mike
that.
And Derby.
Good morning, guys.
Morning.
Hey.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm going to go with the Halligan bar or the Kelly bar.
Oh, dude, you must be on a job. Only guys on the job know the name of it. Yeah, the Halligan or a set of irons is one of the coolest. One of those coolest, most simple tools that we have. It's basically a big steel bar with a couple twists and turns on it, and usually it's made with a 10-pound axe, and you can wreak havoc on just about any door they make with it. We can get right in.
Nice.
It's used every day in all different ways. It's very simple. It was actually developed from people that used to break into safes early on, like in the, early in the 20th century, and sometimes when they get caught, they'd find their tools. And I guess this one of the guys from FDNY, got a hold of some of these tools, and he says, we could use this thing.
Right.
and he started to make his own. It was really crazy.
So a safe cracker.
That's what they would pry the safe door open.
Yeah.
And they would use these tools that they made themselves, the bad guys. And so, the fire department took the bad guy tools. And now it's a tool that we use every day all over the country, probably used 10,000 times a day. And you could rapidly get into just about any sort of door.
Sounds heavy.
It is. I think the whole assembly is probably 20, 25 pounds.
It's a lot when you're carrying a bunch of other stuff.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, the air pack is heavy. The gear is heavy. You're easily toting, 40 to 50 pounds with your gear and with your air pack and with, your tools. Sometimes you have to carry a pressurized water extinguisher or hose. It's seriously heavy-duty hiking.
Wow.
It's like hiking with a snowsuit on.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Doug in Iverton.
Good morning.
Morning.
How about the tick?
The tick?
Thermal imaging cameras. Now we've had them for a while, but when I first got on, they were new, and that allows us to see through smoke and at night and see images. They're very common now, and most of the public knows about them. Ours are a little bit finer tuned and a little bit higher quality than what you could buy, on eBay or something. But credited with saving many lives, allows us to rapidly find people in a smoke field where you could not see it all because you can't see in a fire anyway.
Was it goggles or something?
Some of them are, but usually they're like a something that you would put up to your face piece and look at, like a camera. There's like a little handle, and you kind of look through it. You look through a screen.
Oh. Huh.
Yeah, and even better, you could tell where the fire is if you can't find it, because sometimes you just can't find the fire because you can't see. And so we could pick it up and see there's the source of the fire, or if we could see if the fire's below us so we don't fall through the floor. It's not on this floor, it's on the floor below. That happens quite a bit.
Yeah.
And or if it's above us, or you could see changing fire conditions.
What about bodies?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The change is if it has a temperature, if it emits heat, we can see it. So if you're down on the floor and the room is hot above, we can still see you.
Wow.
Your body heat will show up. So it's really neat. Very good for finding people, victims in the woods or in the water who've gone overboard on their boat, and you can see them in the water.
I think I heard about that being used recently after that boat accident.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
99.1 PLR, Chaz and AJ in the morning. Bruce Steffen is on the show right now. 23 years ago today, he was on the 65th floor of the North Tower, and his wife was in the South Tower. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning.
Morning.
Tell us about that day.
Well, it's actually somewhat of a love story. I mean, we got up a little earlier than normal, and we actually got to the World Trade Center on time, when normally we're a little late for work, so we probably wouldn't have even been there. And we got up to our offices. I had enough time to put my laptop on my desk, walk over to the water cooler, and I hear this big explosion as I'm coming back. And it sounded like a bomb went off a couple floors above us or whatever, but in reality it was that plane plowing right into the building. And then the next thing that I heard,
it plowed into your building.
Yeah, I was the first building hit.
Wow.
And what was that like? You thought it was an explosion. Did the whole building shake?
Well, you heard the sound. The next thing you heard was like a kind of creaking, and the building was swaying from side to side. So you heard this, and then the other way.
Terrifying.
And then I heard the sound of tinkling, like this sort of bells by the window. And you look out and there's flaming pieces of glass coming down. And you know something's wrong there. And right around then, someone said, what do we do? And I said, get to the stairs. And we went to the stairs and just started filing down 65 flights of stairs. For me, it was pretty much that. I got down to the ground floor eventually. Firemen were coming up and slowed us up a little. It took probably an hour plus to get down all the way. And then they rushed us out of the building, through the basement. The basement's all flooded. We get across the street. I'm standing by the church where all the memorials were hung later. I look up and I see that my wife's building has also been hit, the other tower. And it's hit kind of on the same floor I was on. And she was on the 92nd floor, so she would be above that 65th floor. And at that point, people were jumping out of the windows. And I looked up and all I could think of was, my wife said, I don't mind dying, but I don't want to know what's coming. And when you have to make a choice between jumping or burning, I couldn't even imagine. And I went into a kind of zombie state, and I went to find a phone somewhere so I could call the parents and see what was up. And so when I got out, I finally found a place. It was a few blocks away. I called up and I eventually got through to them. The phones weren't working as good as they do now. And they said, at least one of us made it out of the building alive. And they said, oh, Joan called an hour ago. Where were you? No big deal. And I pretty much collapsed on the floor. And I called my parents. And as I'm talking to my father, I hear these explosions, which ended up being her tower falling. Her tower fell first, even though it was hit second, because the plane came in on that angle and took out more floors, I guess. So I told him, I got to go. I think they're bombing Lower Manhattan. I had no idea what was going on. I hang up, and now I try to call my wife's family back again, and there's no answer. And it went on like that for hours. I was actually in a synagogue. I was, a block or two away from the Trade Center. And, I went to leave, and the dust from the collapse of the building was everywhere. And people were walking, and it was piled up on their shoulders and carrying their briefcases like they were going to work. And I went back in the building, and then we got thrown out of the building by the rabbi, who said, I shouldn't have kept you in here. The building's condemned. We got to get out. And I left, and I'm sucking in that air, and I said, I got to get back in. And I go back in, and the door's locked, and it was those double wooden doors, and I pulled them hard. And they opened, and I went back in, and I started swinging the door open and saying, come in and save your lungs. And I had firemen coming in. We filled the whole synagogue. The rabbi was far away. And what was amazing is the firemen would come in, they'd collapse on the floor. We'd wipe all the dust off their face, and they'd drink a drink of water and go back out. And eventually, people from hospitals were out handing out masks so that, you could protect your lungs a little bit. And I started walking uptown to get to my wife's family, who lived in Manhattan, and see if she was still alive. And as the hours went by, I was pretty much convinced that she hadn't made it out. I mean, there was no way. She was above where the plane was.
What floor did the plane hit on the South Tower?
And the South Tower was my building, right? That was the first one hit. So that was the 60th. The plane hit my floor around her floor, about in the 90s. And the plane hit her building on around my building. In other words, the planes hit exactly on the floors that the opposite person was on. Not exactly, but within a few floors. And that was kind of important because my wife was sitting in her office and she had a window office. And when the plane hit my building, the flame that shot out the other side of the building went right past her windows. And she saw this unbelievable bright orange flame going by. She saw pieces of paper flying through the air. And she said, I got to get the hell out of here. I don't know what's going on. She tried to pick up her phone. It was so hot she couldn't touch it. And she got in an elevator. Her building hadn't been hit yet. And she got in the elevator and she got down to 78. Wow. And on 78, she talked to people who were trying to have a conversation with her. And she said, look, I'm going to go. And I think you should go. You should not be hanging around here. I'm going downstairs. And she got in another elevator and got the 44. And then she was walking down the stairs and was on about the 10th floor when the plane hit the building and the lights went out and the generator kicked in and the dust came out. And she just kind of kept walking and eventually got out and was with some other people from work and had this long, slow walk all the way uptown to 92nd Street from downtown. That's where I walked to on my own little passageway. And she went with another friend. And it was not until 2 I had made it up to her parents. I was answering the phone every time it rang. It was never Joan. And then suddenly there she was at 1 o'clock. And I'm a hyperactive type A person. And I'm going, what? Where are, oh, thank God, where are you? Where were you? Just what? I mean, we had a stop for coffee. We got some money. It was just like weird. But I ended up meeting her. I ran down to the 50s. She was coming up. And I met her on 2nd Avenue in a cafe, and we, you know, had lunch, and we watched the rescue things go down, and we tried to think of what we could do.
It's shocking to me that you're on the 65th floor, and when that plane hit, it didn't knock you onto the floor.
Yeah.
It tells you about the strength of that building.
The impact it could take, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I'm a civil engineer, and my client was the Port Authority in New York and New Jersey, and they built that building. And just think about the fact that it imploded. It didn't fall over. It was hit by a plane that was bigger than what it was designed for. It was designed for the biggest plane at the time, and it got hit by a 747, which wasn't in existence at that time. So it was designed to be hit by a plane, but just not a plane that big. And it just imploded, which saved God knows how many people's lives.
Right. What took that building down? Was it the jet fuel burning the center rod?
My answer, yes. The jet fuel immediately went on fire. In fact, one of the people who made it out of the building told me that they saw this bright blue flame shooting out the little crack in the elevator door. The door was closed. It wasn't stopping on that floor, but the flames shot right across the room. And, you know, luckily no one was standing right where it hit. But the building was supported on steel supports. Each of those concrete floors had some steel supports, and steel melts at a pretty low temperature. Wood would actually stay up longer than steel. And so as those supports for the floor started to melt, then the floor came down and pancaked to the floor below. And then the floor below couldn't carry the strength of 2 floors of concrete. And so it just proceeded to collapse all the way down.
How long did it take you to get from the 65th floor out?
About an hour and a half.
Wow.
Yeah, when we got, like, we were going down pretty steady. There was a continuous stream of people. And one of the things that was amazing about that day is I was walking with a somewhat overweight woman who had things she was trying to carry, and I was carrying the stuff for her, and we kind of blocked the stairway, and there was like 2 floors ahead of us that had no people in it, and nobody behind us pushed forward, nobody panicked, everybody helped everybody else on those stairs. And then we got, I forget exactly what floor, but the firemen started coming up, and
right,
all of a sudden, everything stops. We're not continuously moving. And you hear this collective all the way up and down the stairway. And, you know, everyone starts to panic a little bit. And then, you know, they were coming up one side, we were going down the other. And so we started to move again, and everything was cool again for the whole way down. But it took a long time, and everybody stayed calm, and everybody stayed cool. In fact, there was a woman who worked on my floor who was a quadriplegic who was in a wheelchair and worked at the Port Authority. And years later, I ran into her over on 34th Street, and she had made it out of the building, and someone carried her down.
Wow.
how many fours?
I don't know. I wasn't there when they carried her down. I saw her afterwards, and she told me the story, but I have no idea. Wow. She was up on a high floor with me, though, where the Port Authority was.
It's amazing.
I just remember seeing the NBC footage of the firefighters going up the stairs as everyone was going down the stairs, and it's such a... Yeah, it's like
it's chilling.
I'll just never forget seeing that, knowing where you're going and what you're doing.
Yeah.
And the chance of coming down, probably not great, but still going anyway. It's really striking.
What hit me, too, is when I got to the mezzanine level of the World Trade Center coming out of the stairway, there was a firefighter, a rescue worker, who was standing by that stairway and telling us, like, we didn't know what had happened. We didn't know about planes. We didn't know anything. And he's going, run, 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 run. And then I'm trying on my phone to call because I know my wife's in the other building and I wanted to find out. And it wouldn't work. And I went to him and I said, what happened? And he said, a plane hit the building. And I said, well, how's the other building? And he said, it was two planes. And that's when I said, terrorism. And so I tried to call my wife. I couldn't get through to her. He asked to borrow my phone. He couldn't get through to his family. He showed me his badge, his name tag, and he said, if I don't make it out of this building, tell my family where I was. And I thought, oh, my God, you're on the ground floor, and all you're doing is directing us to get to a stairway, and you're going to stay there and die for us. That was incredible. I luckily was able to find out. My friend knew some of the people who were with the FBI who were in the building. And most of the rescue workers who went into my tower got out alive because when the second building collapsed, when my wife's building collapsed, they evacuated everybody out of the first building. So they made it out. He made it out.
Good. Good. Dave Russell, retired NYFD lieutenant.
Yes.
In studio. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you very much for honoring what happened today. Because it's definitely... just disappeared off the radar.
I do see some coverage on television, so that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some, but I was watching the news today. I just happened to turn on Fox. They're set up at Ground Zero, and they had this, and people are jogging by and asking these guys, why are you here today?
Oh.
At Ground Zero.
Right.
On September 11th. So,
yeah. You know, it's interesting. Yeah. What's the age cutoff, do you think? Like, if you were 3 or 4, you probably don't know.
Right.
At the time, so like, if you're in your young 20s, I would say you probably don't have a great awareness.
No. But like your 30s, something like that, like late 20s, 30s, you definitely knew.
Yeah, but the same thing is that it's not taught. It's not part of American history.
Right.
It shouldn't be.
Because they're worried that they might offend the Muslims or whatever. And I'm like, who did it?
Yeah.
And the bottom line is, it's just like, this happened shortly after December 7th.
Pull the mic right over to you. Dave. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. But I always said this, that eventually it's going to be, this happened right after Pearl Harbor, and it's going to disappear because definitely people are more worried about their new iPhones than they are about history of this country.
Yeah. Well, some. You know, we hear about the knuckleheads. They get all the attention, but there's a lot of good people.
Yes,
oh, yeah.
So bring us back. You had the day off 23 years ago today.
Yeah, wow, it's 23 years.
Yeah.
Some days it's like yesterday, and some days it's 40 years.
Chad said it earlier, yeah.
Yeah. I was off. We were working on our house. April and I, we were working on a house. It was pretty much gutted. And it was in the morning, obviously, and I was downstairs. I can always remember in the first floor, gutting the bathroom with the Sawzall, and I hear the phone ring, and it's like, all right. And my wife... being married to a dopey fireman, she knows all the lingo. And so I said, hello? She goes, you're going to work, which means there's a job or a fire or something. Like, what are you talking about? She goes, you're going to work. All right, what are you talking about? She goes, they're saying a small plane just hit the World Trade Center. So I said, BS. And she goes, it's on every TV station. So we went to the one room we were living in. I had my little GI television with... back with antennas.
Yeah, right.
You know.
Yeah.
And I remember I was watching Channel 5, and I turned it on, and they're zooming into the top of the tower, and I'm like, I just started counting. 1, 2, 3, 4. I said, that's no small plane. I got to go.
Is that right?
Because, you know, if that was a Cessna or a Beechcraft or something, the thing would be stuck like a bug on the grill of a car.
Not that kind of damage.
So I called my division at the time. I was a lieutenant in 62 engine, and I said, "Hey, is there a recall or anything going on?" He goes,
"What does that mean? Calling everybody in."
He said, "No, not at this time." So I said, "All right, I think we're just going to go." And at that time, I made a big decision. I'd gear in my car, drive straight to the scene, which a lot of guys did, or go to the firehouse. And I said, as a company officer, I'll go to the firehouse, do the right thing.
Yeah.
And en route, second plane hit. I said, that's no accident. We're at war.
Yeah, yeah. This is deliberate, yeah.
Yeah, and this is before anything else was going on. And I was going faster than the posted speed limit to get to the firehouse, and I made pretty good time.
Good.
And guys were coming in, and we grabbed as much stuff as we could in the firehouse, you know, all in the stock room and all in the tool supply room. We didn't take anything off the rigs because everything was in service. So the trucks
were already gone.
Well, in the Bronx, they were still there. Most of the companies in the Bronx were still there. We had no idea. I had no idea how big it was.
No one knew how big this was. So the trucks are still there, but they're on call. So you can't take stuff off of the trucks that are on call.
No, don't
screw. So you're grabbing stuff out of the car. All right, got it.
Yeah, yeah. So we're taking anything spare. And we went to the division, 7th Division, over on Webster Avenue, and guys are coming in. And we're grabbing radios and anything else. And we determined that we wanted to get down there, and myself and Tony Tanguletta were from 79 Engine. There was a bus across the street, and not any bus. I couldn't get that. I got a flexi bus.
Right.
Yeah, you know, which is twice as long and twice as slow.
Right.
You know,
this was available. Yes. Yeah.
So Tony and I walked onto the bus, and it was loaded with a lot of civilians. And I had verbal blackout. I don't know exactly what I said, but I'm sure it'd be,
get the F off this bus.
That would be the politest thing I would have said.
That's probably a good quote, yeah.
Yeah. And they were still semi-hesitant.
Did they know? Did people know yet?
No.
No.
No, no. Nobody really knew.
It wasn't like cell phone era where
everyone would
know by this time.
Instantaneous, yeah.
People would be leaving the city.
Right.
Right. People are just going about their day. You jump on a bus with how many firefighters?
It was over 50.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, and guys were in their civilian clothes grabbing our fire gear. We call it bunkers and tools and Halligans and hooks and everything we could have, radios and everything else. And they finally realized we were legit, and there was a more verbal blackout, and they finally got off the bus, and we didn't have a cop escort. We had nothing, and we ended up going down Webster, and the bus driver was awesome. To this day, I regret not getting his name, because at the end of the story, it was amazing. So now we're running red lights in a giant flexi bus. It would have been easier to drive a blimp or a John boat down the
street.
So as we're trying to get across Fordham and all these roads, and he knew exactly how to get to the highways where we wanted to go. And it's like, and everybody's yelling, go! I mean, go, let's go. And I look, I'm standing right behind the driver, and that guy's foot is pressed to the floor. And, you know, the bus is like going, what? Let's move. Let's go.
I know for the speed.
Yeah. And we never got hit. I don't think we hit anything. But
it's okay if we did.
Yeah, we were, you know, making a delivery, and we ended up getting on the FDR drive. And as we're coming down, I talked to the guy. I said, listen, when you get a second, if possible, all the guys are leaving their personal stuff on the bus. Maybe get it back there. So we end up going down the FDR drive, and that's when you realized it was the real deal.
So everyone changed out of their personal stuff.
Oh, yeah, just throwing the stuff, stripping and putting their gear on.
It's kind of like Superman in the phone booth.
Right.
Without a phone booth.
On the bus, yes.
But we weren't,
in
you know,
a
we're just.
Bus. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, again, we were
just suiting up
for game day.
What? Yeah. For game day.
Yeah. You know, it turns out to be our Super Bowl. And I remember Tony had a cell phone, so I called my wife to say, listen, you know, we're heading in. I'll see when I see it. Click. And we made the turn, and nobody northbound or southbound on the FDR drive. There's not a car.
When you made that call, was that you kind of saying, if I don't see you again?
I didn't even think of that. No? Just letting her know.
You weren't mentally thinking this was a dangerous job yet.
Yeah, we got to go to work.
Right.
You know, it's a big job and, you know, whatever. We had no idea what was happening down there.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, we got down by the United Nations and you look, there's nobody. It's like, this is
ghost
insane.
Town.
At this time of day, there's nobody on the road, northbound and southbound. That was kind of freaky.
Creepy, yeah.
And then, as I said, I always call it the horizontal tornado. As we're looking south at Manhattan, the smoke going across from Manhattan into Brooklyn.
Yeah.
It was just that horizontal smoke going across. And as we started getting closer, you're looking. Now I got people walking towards us, and some people as clean as we are, and other people were just coated. Like, what's going on? And then as we got closer to the Brooklyn Bridge, it was just like an ant trail. You know, literally thousands of people just walking over the bridge. And the bus driver got us up right onto Broadway with this flexi bus. And
pretty good.
Oh, yeah. He was awesome.
Yeah.
And to his credit, he ended up getting back to the firehouse on Webster and returned all the guy's gear.
Wow.
I don't know how he even got out of there. And we got off, and we always call it like a nuclear winter. The dust was everywhere. It's like walking in a blizzard where everything's muffled. The sound is muffled.
So one of the buildings collapsed by this time?
They're both down.
They're both down by this time.
Yeah, they're both down. And
so you guys didn't see the buildings go down?
No, we were en route. We didn't see any jumpers. We didn't see all that stuff. And I had a group of my guys, and we had the Flanagan brothers. One was in my house 62, and one was in 79 engine, our same battalion, blah, blah, blah. They were legacies. Their father had died line of duty. So
what does that mean?
His father had died from line of duty injuries.
Oh, line of duty.
Yeah, line of duty injuries. So these two guys were legacies. So like the Sullivans in World War II, we decided to split them. So that way if something happened...
It wasn't both at once.
It wasn't both at once, the same thing.
Yeah. That's a chance, yeah.
All right, hold that thought there. Dave Russell in studio. Former NYFD lieutenant. You were a lieutenant?
Yes, sir.
Nice.
And how long were you with the fire department?
Just over 22, 23 years.
Jeez.
No.
And we're going back 23 years now to September 11th. 2001, Dave was not supposed to be working, and as the first plane hit the tower, he grabbed his stuff and went in, and we're going to have the whole story up on the radio station website as a podcast. But so now you're in the city,
right?
And you're separating the Flanagan brothers.
Yeah, we tried to separate them, and we got up on Broadway, and it's, again, you couldn't see 8 feet in front of you, depending where you were. And a couple of guys had went into a high school, and we had an old battalion wagon in the street, and the guys went into school and ripped off all the whiteboards, and were trying to make a command post to figure things out.
Yeah.
And we were using the Staten Island radios for the FDNY, because the Manhattan radios, forget it, it was just insane.
Just everyone talking over one another?
It was traffic.
I never even really heard them. We were just listening to our portable radios that we brought, which was sort of a liability back then. And we started walking around. We separated the Flanagans, and we're heading, and couldn't see, had no idea where you are. And if you grew up in the city and knew the city, wherever you were, you looked at the towers, you could figure out where you were. That was your built-in compass.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was your compass.
Yeah.
That was your lighthouse. Couldn't see them, and we ended up walking, and hindsight 2020 was on Liberty Street where the firehouse 10 and 10 is, 10 engine, 10 truck. And the chief came walking around the corner. He came right up, and he goes, I got an engine company in trouble. I need help. We grabbed some stuff. I had some really great guys, Woogie, Anthony Grella, Mike Gaffney and stuff. Gaffney is like a super mechanic. He makes MacGyver look lame.
There you go.
So, we turned around. Chief was gone. We lost him. I lost him. Remember walking down, and all of a sudden, like through the, you could see like a light. It's like, what is that? All of a sudden, you start feeling heat. And there was a fire engine hooked up to a hydrant. just pumping, nobody there, and the thing was fully involved. Just fire everywhere. It was like a Stephen King novel. Like, what's going on?
So the fire truck is burnt out, but it's still pumping.
It's still on fire.
It's on fire.
It's still working.
But it's still pumping water.
And there's nobody to be found. So later on, when we, hindsight.
That's an eerie sight.
Went right by the firehouse on 10 and 10. Didn't even realize that they were there. And we just started walking. And every place you looked, it was just every corner you went, it just kind of got worse. And we ended up at building 4 and 5, which is the World Trade Center buildings. And they were not on fire at that time. So we went in, we were making a quick push, take a search. Guys had coming out towards us.
What does that mean, quick push?
We're just going to make a quick search because, you know, we didn't know what was going on. The stability of the buildings, they look pretty good, but I mean, you know.
You don't know.
And then I remember we're in the lobby of, I think it was 4, and there's bamboo, like plant. I was like, turns out that was part of their decorations, live bamboo. So, you know, I went from being in Manhattan, now I'm in a jungle for a second with my guys.
It's weird.
It was that, but it's Manhattan.
You're seeing too many weird things one after another.
But it's explainable because it's Manhattan. Everything there is weird. You can get chimps on friggin' skateboards going by, you know.
It's
not
a melting pot, yeah.
Yeah. So then we were going by, and there was an engine sitting there, and it was running, but there was nobody around. And Mike Gaffney, we figured out that there was a broken airline on it. And the brakes were locked up because when you lose air, the brakes adhere. And Mike went immediately and took out a headlight because he knows it, starts messing around with airlines. I have a golf tee in my helmet. We end up plugging the airline.
A vacuum, yeah.
Yeah, you're a mechanic, you know. And released the brakes, took an axe, chopped out the broken windshield, and we drove it down the street, found one hydrant that was finally working. Because almost all the hydrants in that area were broken. Because when the building came down, you never seen all that steel. When that went, it went right into the ground and broke water mains. So we ended up finding a hydrant that was working. Found some duct tape, fixed it, and they brought a tower ladder. You guys call them cherry pickers, a tower ladder, and that was some of the first real water on a fire.
Wow!
And we just kept walking and walking, and then everything's kind of a blur. It's almost like an alcoholic blackout because it's just one thing after another. But
it's too much to remember and take it all in.
But, you know, we're trying to keep everybody together. We're trying to keep our guys as we're passing guys. You know, I saw guys from my reserve unit. They were all firemen. You know, hey, have you seen John Gorman? Because he was a Port Authority cop. No, then you run across Jeff Cool. And nice to see you, brother. Meant so much that day.
Yeah.
You know, how about so-and-so? Nope. Yeah, I just saw him. He's on the other side of the pile. Boom. Because we had no idea how big it was. You know, this is, we're an hour into it.
The pile, that's what we refer to it as the days after that. And people were working it, looking for maybe some survivors the first day or so.
Yeah.
How big was that pile?
16 acres.
16 acres.
You know, and we didn't know how deep it was. There were voids. It, you know, dropped 100 and something feet. It was hills and dales and bottom. And sometimes I attribute it to like old World War One, where you're in a trench and then you climb over a mound and then it drops down and then there's another mound. And we didn't even realize how much fire was actually underneath this. That thing burned. They declared it out in December. So in the history books, it's the longest commercial fire in the history of the United States.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Months,
And it was amazing because I was there for pretty much 6 months. I have pictures, and there's an excavator with a claw on it, and he's on a hill over by where Building 7 had collapsed, and it looked like lava coming down underneath him, and it was melted steel. It was coming out of the ground, and he had grabbed an I-beam with the claw about 30 feet. And there's that rusted end stuff, and as he pulled it out, it was orange. It was just that cherry, like he just pulled it out of a forge.
Yep.
And that's what you were dealing with.
Blacksmith.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it made a giant knife. But the stuff that you saw, and then one day we're working, and there's a roadway that we had down by the south side. You know, construction trucks, the big, giant, giant construction trucks, bulldozers going by, and we're sitting in front of the 10 and 10, and all of a sudden, like a volcano, right through that established roadway, black smoke just started pouring out, and you thought you were in Hawaii waiting for a volcano. It just, there was stuff burning underneath you, you know.
How long were you there that first day, September 11th?
We got back to the firehouse around 4 in the morning.
The 12th?
Yeah, the 12th. Yeah. So we got there to the 12th, and the decision was made that, you know, we worked our normal 24s. They go on to two shifts, A shift, B shift. So if you were, you know, 24 on, 24 off, 24 on, 24 off, I had gotten back. I was on that shift that was supposed to be working. So they let me sleep. The best shower I've ever taken in my life was the shower when I got back.
Yeah.
Talking to Eddie McCallum, and the amount of guys that were missing was just amazing. And it just kept getting, the list just kept getting worse and worse. And if you look at it from our my perspective from the FDNY, how do companies in Brooklyn and Queens, this thing, they pulled companies from the entire city, and a lot of them, you know, they're missing, which means they're
completely gone.
Gone.
Companies completely gone.
Yeah, companies completely gone. I had gone by one of my companies. I was in it was Squad 41 at the time, and I saw the rig. And the rig didn't look bad. So in your mind, you're thinking, if the rig's okay, the guy's got to be.
Yeah.
And around midnight, we found out that the entire company got wiped out. And then Freddie LaFamima, I believe it was stated that he was missing. So I saw him around, I don't know what time in the morning. I go, hey, Freddie. He goes, I know, I heard. And he goes back to like W.C. Fields. He goes, the news of my death is greatly exaggerated. You know, nice to see you, brother.
Yeah.
Amen.
Rory Thompson is on. He's a firefighter and public information officer for Bethel Fire Department. He was at Ground Zero on September 12th. Hey, Rory.
Hey, Chaz. Good morning. How are you today?
Good. Rory, Dave, Rory.
How are you, sir?
Hey, good, Lieutenant. How you doing?
Good. I'm Dave.
Dave.
So tell us, what was that? Did you volunteer to go there? Were you called to go there? How do you end up on Ground Zero September 12th?
I was a volunteer firefighter in Rockville Center on Long Island at the time, and I was working in the city the day of 9/11. Actually, I actually heard the first jet fly over my office. I was working as a magazine editor, and I was typing away, and I was like, what was that noise? That sounds like a jet. That was so weird, you know? And went back to work, and about 15 minutes later, somebody came in and said, you got to come in the lobby and see this on the TV. A plane hit the World Trade Center. So I went in and looked, and I was like, that's not a plane, that's a jet. So, you know, after the second one hit, our boss said, everybody out, we went home. So the next day, I got up Wednesday and went to the firehouse, because that's what we do. And we were standing around, the chief goes, you take the utility truck, go. So we took off. We went to Ground Zero to help in the search and rescue effort. And the weird thing was, it was eerily quiet in the fire truck on the way in, because we knew what was going on. Halfway through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, the lights went out, I guess, on the New York side. And the red lights on the fire truck were spinning around. And all we saw was this white cloud. We're like, what is that? You know, it turned out to be asbestos. We found out later. And come around a curve, there were two MP Jeeps with soldiers there with rifles pointing at us. And they made a stop. And they weren't screwing around. They were serious. Get out of the truck. Keep your hands up. And we're like, okay. And we did. And they searched us. They searched firefighters going in. And we were like, you know, when the guy's got the gun pointed at you, you don't argue with him. You just do it.
No.
We got back in the truck. It was like, what the heck was that about? Okay. So we continued in. We got as far as we go. And we just stopped the truck. And the lieutenant goes, all right, let's go. And we started walking to Ground Zero, and I'm telling this story, and the hair on my arms is sticking up 23 years later. We came down one street. I have no idea what street it was, and the street was literally littered with shoes where people had run out of their shoes running away from the Trade Center, and all of us just collectively were like, whoa. It was just astounding. I can't believe what we saw. And then we got there, and there was, I don't know if Dave can verify this, but there appeared to be nobody in charge. Everybody was just doing their job. Firefighters know when the job's got to be done, you do the job. If there's a command center, you report to command center and get orders. But if nobody's has a parent command, you just jump in and get to work. So we just went to the pile and started digging because we were looking for people. We were looking for firefighters. We were looking for civilians. And we just started digging with whatever tools were around or our hands. And a bucket brigade line had formed where we were just picking junk up and throwing the bucket down the line. They were dumping it. I don't know where these massive dump trucks came from. They were just unloading it. And we just kept doing that, digging through the rubble, looking for things while the pass alarms, the personal alert safety system alarms the firefighters have on their air packs were going off. We could hear them, but we couldn't find them. It was maddeningly frustrating.
Oh, man.
Wow. Yeah.
Do you remember seeing any personal items in the rubble as you were moving it?
I do. At one point, we were picking up. I should have sent this to you guys. I'll follow up with it. I saw four pictures laying against the steel girder, and I just kept looking. They were like 10, 12 feet away from me, and they were color photographs, just, you know, 4x6, whatever. And we're doing the bucket brigade. And finally, a friend of mine, Phil, was close. I said, Phil, grab me those pictures. Grab me those. So he looks at me, grabs them, stuck in my pocket. Long story short, I reached out to New York Daily News after a couple of months after this happened because I was looking for the people who were in the photos. I actually met the woman in the photo. She had survived 9/11, and I was reunited with her. And she told me about the people in the pictures. They all made it out, thank God, that day.
Wow!
And they were on her. They had been on her desk, and somehow they came down. And
which floor?
Oh man, she was on. Oh, I'm gonna say 47, but it was 20 some years ago. But I met her. The Daily News arranged for me to meet her at her new office. She was with the Aon Corporation, and it was really, really emotional.
Wow.
Just seeing her after the fact. But I saw that. And at one point we left the pile. We were searching because the surrounding buildings had been collapsed as well. And they had enough guys, you know, doing the bucket brigade clearing. So my crew went into a building that had been collapsed. And I was like an idiot because I was young and stupid. I went into the building and it just started burrowing down below. And I remember coming upon a desk and a chair and a pink sweater draped perfectly over the back of the chair. It was a secretary's desk. I was like, this day is just getting weirder and weirder. And it was just, you know, we didn't find anybody, but I had to get out. But these things that stick in your mind, you know, two decades later, I'm never going to forget any of that.
Did you find anything in the pile that gave anyone any closure?
I did. Sorry to be gross, but we found body parts. We were picking up body parts, and the call would just go out, red bag, and some medical person would go up with a red bag, and we'd gingerly put the, you know, whatever we found in the bag, and it would disappear. And we did found that. So I never traced that down or chased it down. I really didn't want to know, but I know. No. You know,
but it gave somebody,
yes,
some family, some closure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely did. Yeah, it was just weird. And the really bad thing is I never told my wife where I was going. She said, where are you going? I'm going to the firehouse. They're probably going to detail us to a firehouse in Queens so that they can go to ground zero. I knew exactly where I was going, but I didn't tell her.
Yeah, sometimes it's best.
Yeah. Sometimes it's easier to ask for forgiveness.
Exactly. And you had no idea.
Well, what happened was she hadn't gotten hold of me all day because there was no cell service. And she finally went to the firehouse looking for me about 5 o'clock. And my good buddy, Jeff, Big Mouth, she goes, hey, where's Rory? He goes, oh, he's in the city. She goes, yeah, where? He goes, he's in ground zero. She goes, he's where?
Exactly.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah.
And I got home, and she ripped into me, and I was like, how'd you know that? She goes, Jeff told me. I'm like, I'm going to beat up Jeff.
We always say thank, you know, members of the military and first responders. It's also the families who have to sit back at home and worry.
Absolutely. Amen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a day, as Dave, I'm sure, can attest, we will never forget. We try to keep the memory alive of all those we lost that day, which is why we're having the blood drive today in the Bethel Firehouse. It's a memorial blood drive. It's probably going to be an annual event. And instead of just sitting around and moping, we're trying to do something positive and, you know, pay it forward for the community. So we're asking anybody who's available to stop by Bethel Fire Headquarters on South Street in Bethel from noon till 5. The Red Cross will be there, and everybody's welcome to come and give a pint, maybe save a life.
I remember that was the first reaction after this happened. You know, people at hospitals, emergency rooms got ready for patients, you know, an overflow of patients, and then everyone went down to these makeshift blood drives. We were on Long Island at the time. I know it was happening in Connecticut, New Jersey, and
yeah.
But the patients never came, and there was never the need for blood because just no one made it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I remember we went to, when they kicked us out of the office, we all went to Penn Station, and it was just a sea of humanity. They'd shut down mass transit, and there was some guy riding by on a bicycle goes, go to the hospital, donate blood, they need blood. And we're all looking at him like, yeah, we're not doing that. We're getting the hell out of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got to go see my family.
Rory, how long were you, how many days did you work the pile?
Chaz, I was only there for one day. We were digging the pile, and I remember it was a day. It was funny because I was with a friend of mine yesterday who's an FDNY retired guy. He's got 9/11 cancer. We went to visit him on Long Island yesterday. And we're driving the car. He goes, and he looked up. He goes, wow, weather's just like 9/11. I was like, yeah. We were there that one day. It was hot in the pile, digging through the stuff, you know, looking for things. So I hung my turnout coat on a pole, telephone pole. And at one point, somebody, I don't know who was it, that building's coming down, and we look up, and sure as hell, the building next to us was vibrating, and everybody just scattered. Like, you ever see these videos of the helicopters flying over the savannah in Africa when they, you know, the herds of animals, and they all scatter?
Yeah.
That's what we were just running like crazy.
Fan out pattern, yeah. Just, yep. Fan out pattern.
Gotta go. Back.
Yep.
Gotta go.
Get away from here, yeah.
Which one was that? Was that Tower 7?
I believe it was. I don't know. It was just a confusing day. But we got about two blocks away, and we're like, you know, trying to gas and catch our breath. What the hell was that about?
Yeah.
So we all calmed down about a half hour, and we walk back in, and some captain from the FDNY goes, stops. He goes, stop. I said, what? He goes, thank you guys for coming. We really appreciate it. We got it from you. You got to go. I'm like, all right, Cap, I understand. It's like 4 or 5 o'clock in the end. I said, but my code, my turnout code's there on the pole, like a block away. Can I go get it? He goes, no. I said, Captain, it's my code. He goes, no. And, you know, we follow chain of command. You get an order. Yeah. Follow the order. So I lost my coat that day.
You never got it back.
I went back down to truck 10, engine 10, which is the firehouse right by the Trade Center. About, I'm going to say 6 weeks later, just went in. I said to the guy who was on duty, I said, look, I explained the story. I lost my coat. He goes, this coat's in here. You can look for it, brother. Go ahead. And I looked. I never found it. And I even put in the story in the Daily News when I met that woman where I reunited her with her photographs. And I mentioned, I want to get my coat back. I don't know where it is. I hope it's not in some jerk's man cave.
Right.
I think somebody picked up a souvenir.
Seriously.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I just, so it was one day, but I got the cancer. Got it twice. I got the prostate and the thyroid cancer just in breathing. Well, I mean, we were breathing like marathoners, and nobody had masks because the government said, oh, the air is safe to breathe.
Yeah.
Okay. I remember that news conference, by the way.
Yep.
Yeah.
Whitman.
Christy Todd Whitman. Thank you, Christy. Yes. Really? Yeah, so I had prostate cancer really soon afterward, and then thyroid cancer popped up in 2014. But thank God my doctor caught both early. I was treated Sloan Kettering very successfully, and knock wood, cancer-free.
Knock wood now.
Knock on wood. Amen. Knocking on wood.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right, Rory, we're going to link up on the WPLR website for the Bethel Volunteer Fire Department hosting a blood drive today from noon to 5 in remembrance of 9/11. Let's do something productive.
Yep.
Amen.
I love it.
AJ, appreciate it. Dave, thanks much for your service. We do appreciate it.
Well, listen.
Have a great day and stay safe, huh?
Thank you, Rory.
Stay safe, bro.
Rory J. Thompson. Alicia in Oxford.
Morning, gentlemen and Lady Ruth. Little bit of a backstory. So I grew up in Oxford, but my grandmother lived in Queens. So I spent my summers and all of my holidays in the city. And I was standing in the bank behind a woman, and she said to the teller, did you hear a plane just accidentally flew into the World Trade Center? And my first reaction was, that's not an accident. And she turned around and gave me this awful look. And how can you say that? And I said, it's a beautiful sky blue day. It was so gorgeous, which you guys remember. And yeah. I said, you can see the city line for miles. That's not an accident. And originally, they thought it was like a Piper jet or, you know, like a little Piper airplane or something. And that's happened prior, you know, to different buildings in the city. And I ran home. My mom lives up behind Tommy K's, and ran into her house, and she had the news on. And we watched the second plane fly in. My stepfather is a Bridgeport fireman. My brother is in the military police and National Guard. My daughter was in third grade at the time, and I thought, well, she's safe at school. And my stepfather spent weeks down at Ground Zero helping to dig. I worked for a New Haven County 911 dispatch center at the time, and, you know, all hands on deck. We were all called into work because we thought that people would be coming in injured, and we'd be getting people bused or ambulanced in. All the ambulances from New Haven went down to the city. Oxford Ambulance filled their ambulance with food and water, and they rallied and went to Shea Stadium and stayed there for days to be able to replenish firemen and workers, and they used it as a staging area before everybody went into the city and to help out. And by 1 o'clock, my brother called me and said they have mobilized us to go to Oxford Airport and close it down and guard it. So when somebody talked about going through the tunnel and having two MPs meet him, that was when I think, you know, like growing up and knowing that I knew people that died, or I was going to know people that died in the city, several firefighters and people that worked in the building, and knowing people that were working down there and worried about their safety and living down there. But then I went to school and picked up my daughter because it was, okay, Oxford, you know, like we have the biggest runway in the state next to Brainerd, you know, so that either the president could land there or a terrorist could land there, or that it was, you know, little old Oxford keeps on coming up in the news. 23 years later, it still is very real about that day. And thanks, guys, for letting people talk and remembering, because if we don't remember, we're definitely going to repeat some of these things that are occurring in our world.
Alicia, great call. Thank you.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.